The Salmon of Doubt, Disc 7.
Chapter 6. The following morning the weather was so foul it hardly deserved the name, and Dirk decided to call it Stanley instead. Stanley wasn't a good downpour. Nothing wrong with a good downpour for clearing the air. Stanley was the sort of thing you needed a good downpour to clear the air of. Stanley was muggy, close and oppressive, like someone large and sweaty pressed up against you in a tube train. Stanley didn't rain, but every so often he dribbled on you. Dirk stood outside in the Stanley. The actor had kept him waiting for over an hour now, and Dirk was beginning to wish that he had stuck by his own opinion that actors never got up in the morning. Instead of which, he had turned up rather eagerly outside the actor's flat at about 8:30, and then stood behind a tree for an hour. Nearly an hour and a half now. There was a brief moment of excitement when a motorcycle messenger arrived and delivered a small package, but that was about it. Dirk lurked about 20 yards from the actor's door. The motorcycle messenger arrival incident had surprised him a bit. The actor didn't seem to be a particularly prosperous one. He looked as if he was more in the... Dirk shot out an arm and it drew to a halt beside him. "Follow that cab!" exclaimed Dirk, clambering into the back. "I've been a cabbie over 20 years now," said the cabbie as he slid back into the traffic. "Never had anybody actually say that to me." Dirk sat perched on the edge of his seat, watching the cab in front as it threaded its way through the slow, agonizing throttle of the London traffic. "Now, that may seem like a little thing to you, but it's interesting, isn't it?" "What?" said Dirk. "Any time you see anything on the telly where someone jumps in a cab, it's always follow that cab, isn't it?"
"Is it? I've never noticed," said Dirk.
"Well, you wouldn't," said the cabbie. "You're not a cabbie. What you notice depends on who you are. If you're a cabbie, then what you especially notice when you watch the telly," continued the cabbie, "is the cabbies. See what the cabbies are up to, see?"
Yes, said Dirk.
"But on the telly you never actually see the cabbies, see? You only see the people in the back of the cab. Like, the cabbies never of any interest."
I suppose so, said Dirk.
Can you still see the cab we're supposed to be following?" "Oh, yeah, I'm following him okay. So, the only time you ever actually see the cabbie is when a fare says something to him. And when a fare says something to a cabbie in a drama, you know what it invariably is."
"Let me guess," said Dirk. "It's follow that cab."
"Exactly my point. So if what you see on the telly is to be believed, all cabbies..."
"You couldn't happen to tell which flight he's catching, could you?" asked Dirk.
"Who do you think I am, mate?" retorted the cabbie. "A bloody private detective?"
Dirk sat back in his seat and stared out of the window, thoughtfully. Chapter 7.
There must be some kind of disease which causes people to talk like that, and the name for it must be something like airline syllabus stress syndrome. It's the disease that seems to kick in at about 10,000 feet and becomes more and more pronounced, if that's a good word to use in this context, with altitude, until it levels out at a plateau of complete nonsense at about 35,000 feet. It makes otherwise rational people start saying things like, "Flat." But who knows? Maybe he had caught the eye of a Hollywood casting director who was whisking him over for a screen test. It wouldn't be difficult to slip into the first-class cabin and have a quick look round, but it would be difficult to do it without attracting attention. Not on the plane. Dirk had seen him heading in towards passport control, but there had been a moment when he had suddenly looked round, and Dirk had ducked quickly into the bookshop. A few seconds later, when Dirk next glanced up, his quarry had gone into, as Dirk had assumed, passport control. Dirk had lingered for a decent interval, bought some newspapers and books, and then made his way through passport control and into the departure area himself. It had not especially surprised him that hands moved over impossibly perfect lawns. The gates of Bel Air went by, and behind them, perfect houses nestling in perfect bouquets of shrubbery. I've seen exactly those houses on television, and even I, sceptical and sarcastic old me, have felt that I really, really wanted one of them. Luckily, the sort of things that people who live in such houses say to each other make me giggle until tea squirts out of my nose, and so the moment passes. The sleek, desirable blue convertible swept on. There is a set of traffic lights, I understand, on the borders of Bel Air and Brentwood, and as the car approached them, they turned red. The car drew to a halt. The woman shook her hair and adjusted her sunglasses in the mirror to raise money by whatever means seemed to someone like a good idea at the time, a godforsaken funfair, a once quite well-stocked zoo,
and, of more recent provenance, a small high-technology business park. Current occupant, one faltering computer games company, now cast adrift by its American parent, and believed to be the only such company in the world to be making a loss. You can find a billion-barrel oil field in the grounds of Ranting Manor, and you could pretty much guarantee that within a couple of years it would be operating at a loss and would require the selling of the family tin to keep it going. The family silver has long since gone, of course, along with most of the family. Disease, alcohol, drugs, sexual imbecility, and poorly maintained for a moment, and then turned and looked at it again. The low, wooden gate, which should have been secured at this time of night, was standing open. The dog whimpered and snuffled around on the ground, which seemed to have been scuffed and churned up a little. The man hobbled up to the open gate and peered into the darkness beyond. Among the low huddle of buildings, all was darkness, except for a single dim light which glowed from the hut where Roy Harrison, Desmond's keeper from Chatsfield, was staying. Nothing untoward, no sign of movement. So why was the gate open? It probably meant nothing. Most things, the man would have told you if you had asked him, probably meant nothing. Billy shared a big evening with somebody, and that somebody had clearly then pushed off. The visitor tried gently to shake him by the shoulder, but to no avail. He tried again, but this time the keeper slowly slid sideways and collapsed in an untidy, slobbering heap on the floor. The dog was so startled by this that it leapt wildly for cover behind the sofa. Unfortunately, the dog was larger and heavier than the sofa and knocked it backwards as he jumped over it, causing it to topple over on top of him. The dog yelped again, scrabbled briefly at the linoleum, and then leapt for cover once more behind a small coffee table, breaking it. Having run out of places to leap to, the dog cowered back in a corner, quivering with fright. Its master satisfied himself that Roy was inside him. He had a sudden instinct to charge at something, but you couldn't charge at a worrying uncertainty. He nearly stumbled. He drew in another deep breath. He blinked slowly. Ha! The new bit of the world had vanished. Where was it? Where had it gone? There it was again. It unfolded itself blotchily into place, and he felt as if he were tipping over again, but this time he was able to steady himself more quickly. Stupid little lights. Blink, blink, blink. This new bit of the world, what was it? He peered forward uncertainly into it, letting his mind's nostril play over it. Those lights were going, Bram! Run! Hurtle! Charge! Crash! Bang! There seemed to be more bits of fencing around his neck again, and suddenly his progress was rather less free than it had been, and he was all encumbered with stuff. He ploughed on heavily. Suddenly he found himself in a sea of scattering creatures, squealing as his huge bulk careered through them. The air was full of the sound of cries and bellows and little tinkly crashes. Bewildering odours danced around him, a surge of burning meat, heady wafts of some kind of woozy-making stuff, big stabs of viciously sweet musk. He was confused and tried to fix on things by sight. He didn't trust vision very much. It didn't tell him very much. He could just the slowness and gradually found himself enveloped in great waves of warm, glowing blueness. As the world ebbed from him, he heard a gabbling, hysterical voice making sounds that made no sense to him, but they sounded like this. Get the paramedics! Get the police! Not just Malibu! Get the LAPD! Now! Tell them to get a helicopter up here! We've got dead and wounded! And tell them... I don't know how they're going to deal with this, but tell them we've got a dead rhinoceros in the swimming pool! Steve little arrays. A meteorite here, half a cat there. The electronic threads of invisible dollars and unexpected airline tickets that connected them. Before touching down in Chicago, his self-confidence had been in tatters, but now he felt a thrilling tingle of excitement. There was something or someone out there that he had engaged with, something that he uniquely had found and that he was being drawn towards. The fact that he still had no idea who or what it was no longer troubled him. It was there, he had found it, and it had found him. He had felt its pulse. Its face and its name would emerge in their proper times. At Albuquerque Airport, he stood silently for a while under the high-painted beams, surrounded by the dark, staring eyes of the drunk, driving lawyers peering from their billboards. He breathed deeply. He felt calm, he felt good. He felt able to meet with the wild, thrashing improbabilities that lie an atom's depth beneath the dull surface of the narrated world, and to speak their language. He walked unhurriedly to the long escalators, and sailed slowly downwards, like an invisible king. His man was waiting for him. He could tell him immediately. Another still point in the scurrying airport. He was a large, fat, sweaty man, with an ill-fitting black suit, and a face like a badly laid table. He stood a few feet back from the foot of the elevator, gazing up it with an inert but complicated expression. It was as well that Dirk had been ready to spot him, because the sign he held, which read D-J-E-N-T-T-R-Y, was one he might otherwise easily have missed. Dirk introduced himself. The man said his name was Joe, and that he would go and get the car. And that, rather anticlimactically, Dirk felt, was that. Joe kept yanking him back to the surface.
"Beautiful place," said Joe. "Beautiful. If it doesn't get ruined by all the Californians moving in. Californication, they call it. You know what they call it?"
"Californication," hazarded Dirk.
"Fantasy," said Joe. "All the Hollywood types moving in from California, ruining it. Especially since the earthquake. You heard about the earthquake?"
"Well, I did, or even yet in London, which is where I live. Look, I'm sorry about your sister."
"Yeah. Standing on a street corner down on Melrose. Couple of guys drive by in a Mercedes. One of those new ones, you know, with the double glazing, and pow, they blew her away. 500 SEL, I think it was. Midnight blue. Real smart. They must have jacked it. You have carjacking back in old England?"
"Carjacking?"
"People walk up to you, steal your car."
"No, but thanks for asking. We have people who clean your windscreen against your will, but..." Joe barked with contempt. "The thing is," explained Dirk, "in London you could certainly walk up to someone and steal their car, but you wouldn't be able to drive it away."
"Some kind of fin."
"Joe," he said, "you slowed the car down just as we were approaching the sign. Was that deliberately, so that I would see it?" He hoped it wasn't just the whiskey and the jet lag talking.
"Oh, no," said Joe. "I was slowing down for the rhinoceros." "Prospects." "Pretty much what it said yesterday. Of course, that's pretty much what I do every day, just driving around. So I suppose that means something, then. What did yours say?"
"That I would meet a 3-ton rhinoceros called Desmond."
"I guess you can see a different bunch of stars from New Zealand," said Joe. "It's a replacement, that's what I heard,"
volunteered Joe. "A replacement?"
"Yep."
"A replacement for what?"
"Previous rhinoceros."
"Well, I suppose it would hardly be a replacement for a light bulb," said Dirk. "Tell me, what happened to the previous rhinoceros?"
"Died."
"What a tragedy. Where? At the zoo?"
"At a party."
"A party?"
"Yep."
Dirk sucked his lip thoughtfully. There was a principle he liked to adhere to when he remembered, which was never to ask a question unless he was fairly certain he would like the answer. He sucked his other lip. "I think I'll go and take a look myself," he said, and climbed out of the car. The large, dark green truck was pulled into the side of the road. The sides of the truck were about 4 feet high, and a heavy tarpaulin was roped down over an enormous crate. The driver was leaning against the door of the cab, smoking a cigarette. He clearly thought that being in charge of a 3-ton rhinoceros meant that no one would argue with him about this, but he was wrong. The most astonishing amount of abuse was being hurled at him by the drivers negotiating their way one by one past his truck. "Bastards," muttered the driver to himself, as Dirk wandered up to him in a nonchalant kind of way and lit a moment or two to digest this information. Then, "Whose house was this?" he said.
"Just some movie people. Apparently they'd had Bruce Willis around only the previous week. Now this."
"Seems a bit rough on the old rhino as well," said Dirk. "And now here's another one." Adams is 6 feet 5 inches tall, with intensely round eyes. He hadn't had a good day. His daughter was sick, and the croissant he was eating at 5 p.m. was lunch. Life hasn't been bad for the 49-year-old Adams, though. He travels the world, his 9 books have sold over 15 million copies, and the oft-delayed Hitchhiker's movie is now being produced by Disney and has the director of Austin Powers signed on.
The perennial movie, which has been about to be made for about 20 years and is even more about to be made now, Adam said. But we shall see. I wish I'd never thought of doing it as a movie. I'd have about 10 years of my life back. For the first time in over a decade, Adams is working on a book. There was a point where I just got massively fed up with it. My books tend to use up ideas at a ferocious rate, he said. I never intended to be a novelist to begin with, so I decided to go and do a whole bunch of other things. The consequence of that is I have a huge backlog of story ideas, and now the sort of panic is, can I do them all in the rest of my career, given the speed at which they're arriving at the moment? The other panic, of course, is the perennial writer's problem of application. I think I have more fear of writing than most writers. The new book is not a hitchhiker's book. There are already 5 of those, or a Dirk Gently book, but it will be recognizable in style to anyone who knows those books. It was completely magical. So magical that Adams and Carwardine spent the next year traveling the world and seeing endangered animals, like flightless kakapo parrots in New Zealand and Baiji River dolphins in China. The last 20 dolphins will become extinct when the Chinese... slowly and painfully. People assume you sit in a room looking pensive and writing great thoughts, he said. But you mostly sit in a room looking panic-stricken and hoping they haven't put a guard on the door yet. Hopefully, Adam said, what comes out at the end doesn't try to be literature. I always think that literature is best left to the judgments of later generations, he said. It's much better just to be literate and get on with it. I can't help feeling that an awful lot of stuff we call literature, as it's being written, probably will die a death in later years, whereas stuff that's been motivated by something else, other than by a desire to write literature, has some other energy or insight or spirit to it. Adams will probably be writing for the next few years, before his daughter grows up. I think what I'll do, because there has been talk about me doing a big TV documentary series, so I'll wait until her hormones kick in, and then I shall go off like a shot, he said. I think when she's about 13, I'll go off and do a big documentary series and come back when she's become civilized. The interview ended when Adam's cell phone rang from inside his pocket. In the other pocket there was a little bit of padded cotton, red-trimmed with a giraffe on it. It looked like it belonged to his daughter. His wife and daughter were supposed to have flown to London that night, but his daughter came down with an ear infection. A serious one, actually. It was time for Adams to climb into his black Mercedes to go home and see her. And so he does. April the 5th, 2001.
Including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue